First of all, I want to also thank Eugen Edith for organizing this and for giving me the opportunity to be here with you today. Obviously, I'm also not an ecosystem person. So I'm actually a structural biologist, so I come from the rather other end of the resolution spectrum. And so my lab has been interested in mobile genetic elements, and hopefully it will become a little bit more clear later during the presentation why I'm here today. So the mobile DNA elements have been mentioned also in Edith's introduction and also later on in the CRISPR presentation. So so we are fascinated about these selfish jumping pieces of DNA that can entirely self-sufficiently excise and integrate in genomes, move from one location to another. So recent explosion of genome sequence data has clearly highlighted the abundance of all these elements in most organisms across the tree of life. So most genomes are littered with mobile genetic elements or inactive remnants of these. And so, for example, just to highlight the human genome that contains, as you can see in these colored parts of the chart, about 50% of our genome is derived from mobile DNA. But the situation can be even more extreme. Some plants have more than 80% of their genomes built of mobile DNA-derived sequences. So, obviously, these elements, when they move from one location to another, they can disrupt genes and thereby have significant mutagenic consequences on organisms. But it can also change gene expression patterns, even if they do not move into a genome. And so, by this, they clearly create a very strong evolution and like driver for evolution and adaptation in many organisms. And this has been nicely illustrated in many plants, starting with Barbara McClintock's maize example. But also, they contribute to color changes in grapes and in oranges. And so and also in animals. So one example that I wanted to highlight here, because I just find it super fascinating, is, and it, I think it's very nicely illustrates how mobile DNA can contribute to evolutionary advantages. And that is the case of the peppered moths, and where a transposition event has converted this moth into a very dark phenotype, to an essentially black moth during the Industrial Revolution in the UK, which allowed these insects to hide much better on polluted tree trunks, essentially allowing them to survive much better. Transposons and other mobile genetic elements move also in humans, and clearly they have an opportunity to move during, in the germline, when epigenetic silencing is reduced. Recent seminal discoveries have also shown that mobile elements move in the brain, so during neuronal development. Research from Fred Gage's lab has suggested that this movement of transposons in the brain contribute to are influenced by the environment and epigenetic effect, but also then contribute to neurological phenotypes. This obviously will have to remain to be proven, but it just highlights the diverse kinds of consequences mobile elements can have. So for today, I want to primarily focus on mobile genetic elements in bacteria, which certainly provide very strong evolutionary and adaptational drivers in bacteria and bacterial communities as well. So clearly, by creating mutations, mobile elements can drive adaptation in bacteria as well, allowing them to overcome challenges of the environment and creating bacterial cells that can better survive in the new environment. So they also can carry resistance and virulence genes, and move them not only inside the cell but also between bacterial cells, which then further increases the evolutionary potential. and strengths of these bugs, and we can. So, and we have heard a lot about microbial communities already today, and so these microbial communities, because cells can closely interact inside these communities, they allow a very efficient hotspot or bed for genetic exchange between bacteria. So clearly, gene transfer by mobile element is a very important topic in understanding bacterial communities and their adaptation to new environments. One major reason why we should care about gene transfer in bacteria is the fact that we are facing a really terrible crisis of antibiotic resistance today. So drug-resistant infections now cause millions and millions, and drug-resistant bacteria cause millions and millions of infections worldwide, and the numbers are really rapidly increasing. So today, the death rates from antimicrobial-resistant bacterial infections are equal to those of car accidents, and the WHO, for example, predicts that by 2050, these numbers will exceed those of cancer and AIDS and all of these like terrible diseases that we have today. So, in addition to the fact that these multi-drug-resistant infections are very difficult to treat, resistance also hampers the development of new drugs, which clearly amplifies the problem. So, it's becoming worse and worse. As we go along. So here I just highlighted a few risk factors that enhance antibiotic resistance development. And so this is, I mean, we hear a lot about the overuse of antibiotics in the clinic, but obviously also, but this is also an issue in farming and in the environment altogether. So suboptimal hygiene in hospitals and throughout clearly further promotes the resistance spreading. Yes, and then so one important matter that has been less discussed and less studied today as to date is that the pollution, antibiotic pollution in natural habitats enhances resistance spreading and resistance development and impacts waters, soil, and then comes back to us through the food that we eat. So despite all these clear issues related to antibiotic resistance, how resistance emerges and spreads in microbial communities is still poorly understood. So during the last years, my lab has been very interested in understanding the mechanisms of mobile genetic elements and transposons in particular in bacteria to help overcome some of it, or to help create understanding, but then ultimately also help overcome resistance spreading. So one particular class of elements that we have been focusing on are so-called conjugative transposons. They're also often referred to as integrative conjugative elements in bacteria. So we are focusing on this for an important reason, because they can not only excise within a genome and then integrate elsewhere in the genome, but can also self-sufficiently move from one bacterial cell to another. And thereby, so when they cross species barriers, they can also then integrate into the genome in the new species, thereby fixing the resistance and creating a new resistant bug. So these elements also very frequently contain antibiotic resistance genes. And so when they hop from one bug to another, they create a bug that is resistant to the antibiotic that the parent cell has been resistant to. And so if you do this a couple of times with different types of resistance genes, then very quickly you develop a multi-drug resistant bug that is then almost essentially impossible to treat, because we quickly run out of antibiotics that we could use to kill this bug. So. So one of the major hurdles in understanding mobile genetic element mechanisms and the impact on bacteria and in our lives, is that we still lack tools, especially computational tools, that, to track them properly, to find them, to track them properly, and follow their movements. So to improve this, in collaboration with Alex Bateman at the EBI, and more recently with Per Bork in our own department at the AMBL, so we have been looking, and we have been trying to develop bioinformatic tools to identify and characterize conjugative transposons in particular in different bacterial taxa. So what you see here is a survey of conjugative transposons in all sequenced bacterial genomes, and what I've highlighted is a phylogenetic tree highlighting the diversity of all these elements the different types of elements that we find. So there are like five major groups of conjugative transposons that you find here, and I want to focus your attention on this class called, you might not be able to read, but TN916-like elements, which is, as you can see, they are most diverse across all types of tyrosine recombinase-driven conjugative transposons. So on the right side, you can see the abundance of these elements in different types of bacteria. And so here you can also, the last column illustrates the TN916-like elements, and you can see that they are present in very diverse types of bacterial taxa. And so then, obviously, being a structural biologist, we wanted to dig into understanding how these elements move and how they can actually spread in all these different types of bacteria. And so for this, we had to focus in a bit. And so we have chosen a model element called TN1549, which carries vancomycin resistance. It's present in enterococci and in clostridium, streptococci, and different types of bacteria. And it's actually the main source of Van B resistance in clinical isolates of vancomycin-resistant enterococci. So what you see on the right side is a map of vancomycin-resistant enterococcus across Europe. And as you can see, that in some countries, it's up to 50% of enterococci isolates in the clinic are resistant to vancomycin. So this is essentially, vancomycin is the last resort drug. It's very difficult to use drug. So if a bug is resistant to vancomycin, then we don't really have more antibiotics to treat it. And vancomycin is frequently used to treat, for example, clostridium and like multi-resistant clostridium infections and MRSA, which both of which are a major health concern right now. And so the risk of these becoming resistant to vancomycin is a threatening one. So that's one of the reasons why we picked this example, but the other reason is that we have been able to reconstitute the movement of these elements in bacteria so that we had developed tools to follow their movements in vitro. And so so work in our group, but also by others, have shown that these elements contain all the genes required for autonomous conjugation and integration in the genome. And so the pink thingy here is the vancomycin resistance gene inside the transposon. So what we were able to show is that excision of the transposon from the genome creates a small DNA circle that by itself cannot replicate, but it serves as a substrate for conjugation that can then be transferred to a recipient cell autonomously through with the help of the conjugation machinery that is included on the element itself. So excision and integration of these elements is actually a process that is very similar, is essentially based on DNA recombination, which is. Yeah. So So the process, the molecular process itself, and now here it gets really mechanistic, but I'll try to, I hope you can bear with me for a second until I try to explain you what were the main questions that we have been asking. So, so basically what needs to happen here for the transposon to excise or integrate into its genome a protein needs to recombine the two ends of the transposon to create a circle, and then the circle integrates itself into the new genome by recombination of the transposon ends, the joint transposon ends with the target DNA substrate. So this process is in fact very similar to site-specific recombination as you know it from the Cre recombinase and other canonical conservative recombination systems, which essentially strictly require homology between the DNA sites. So what happens is that the protein that recombinase or transposes that binds to that it brings together two DNA substrates in a tetrameric complex, then cuts to both DNA sites each on one strand, and then exchanges these DNA strands to create a so-called holiday junction intermediate. And then a second set of cleavage events then resolves this holiday junction intermediate into the product. Now, this reaction happens without the need for any energy cofactors. It can happen by itself, and mainly this is driven by the fact, and this is possible because the central parts of the DNA are homologous to each other. So you, by exchanging these strands, you lose no energy, right? I mean, you invest some, but you regain the same energy because you have the same base pairs on the other end. Yes, so, and there has been quite a bit of structural work on canonical tyrosine recombinases, and they usually form a tetrameric complex synapsing the two recombination substrate DNA molecules. So for transposition, on the other hand, the transposon, I will now focus on the integration of the transposon into the genome because I think this is the easiest to illustrate or explain our mechanistic questions here. So for integration of the transposon into a target genome, in order for this transposon to be able to spread to diverse genomes it needs to be able to integrate into diverse sequences in all these genomes. Now, for this, what this means is that the transposase, if it works something similar to the recombinase, it needs to bind and needs to synapse two sites. One is a specific site, the other is a random site, and when it exchanges the strands, it has no base pairing to recover. So when it cuts and exchanges the strands, it has to melt DNA, melt six base pairs on both substrates and cannot regain any base pairing on the other strand. So but this the fact that it can do this and it can exchange strands without homology is absolutely critical for the transposon to move to diverse sites and spread broadly. So we were very curious to understand how this happens on the molecular level. So what you see here is that to address these questions, we wanted to determine structures of the transposase bound to transposon DNA. And so here you can see our first structure where there are two transposase molecules bound to a single DNA that represents the central part of the excised transposon circle, so the one that needs to integrate into the target. And so, I mean, first of all, you can see this is not a tetramer as it was for Cre, and I will come back to that and explain, try to explain you why that is. But so then the next thing that those of you who are used to looking at DNA structures can spot is that the central part of the DNA has an unusual structure. So it is unwound, and it is actually melted in the center. So this you can see better in this Zoom, probably. So the central part of the DNA, the one, this red part that needs to recombine with the target, has been melted by the invasion of an arginine residue from the protein that causes the first base of the central region to flip out. And this distortion then generates an overall distortion throughout the entire crossover region, where the DNA bases are not paired anymore, they are more like stacking to each other. So then we wondered whether this unusual DNA structure is important for transposition, and you can see here assays that we have performed in vitro. So this is a DNA recombination assay where we checked whether the transposase requires this DNA melting, and in fact the residues that are needed for this melting to recombine DNA substrates. And here you can see that if we mutate the arginine residue that initiates the unwinding and melting of the DNA into an alanine, the recombination is greatly reduced. Same thing in vivo. We have established an assay where we can monitor excision of the transposon from a DNA plasmid, and so with the wild type transposase, with the wild type transposes, you get an excised circle down here, and also the resealed donor backbone. But with all the mutants that we have tested, there is no, essentially very little excision. Most of the substrate plasmid is untouched. So another surprise in our structure was the fact that the catalytic residue that is responsible for cutting the DNA was actually quite far from the DNA. And it was pulled away by the C-terminal helix of the protein that is docked into a tight pocket on the partner molecule. So this suggested that the structure that we had captured is actually an inactive state of the reaction, and additional conformational changes will be needed for it to get activated and cut DNA. And so this we have also proved by shortening the C-terminal helix that blocks the transposase into this inactive state. And you can see by shortening the weakening this interaction, here's this autoinhibitory interaction here, we get a hyperactive transposon recombination phenotype. So this brings me to our current model of transposition, and I try to explain to you how we think this transposase now allows the transposon to move into very diverse sites. So essentially, our data has shown that the transposase binds to the transposon DNA as an auto-inhibited inactive dimer, but it already melts the central part of the DNA so as to prepare it for recombination afterwards. This opening will then help the DNA to let go after cleavage. It will help the DNA strand to let go and move to its target substrate, as you can see here. But obviously, how things go on from here? How is target DNA captured in this complex or another complex? This remains to be understood. And so, based on models from other tyrosine recombinases, we hypothesized that target capture will happen in a tetrameric complex which unites the target and the transposon DNA, and this. Will most probably require major conformational changes that will then activate the transposase. So just to give you an idea of how this could work, the tetrameric complex should have a very different conformation with the DNA bend, and this DNA bending then changes the positioning of the C-terminal helix, and thereby helps assemble the active site and triggers recombination. So, and in fact, our preliminary we now have a preliminary structure with the Halliday junction DNA, which shows us as a very reminiscent tetramer. So based on this data, we were then next wondering, can we use our structure to try to inhibit transposition? So the idea here would be that if you can inhibit transposition or inhibit the transfer of resistance genes between bacteria, so for example, as a complementary treatment to antibiotic use in the clinic, then you could limit the transfer of resistance genes to the microbiota and in these patients. So based on our structure, we came up with two strategies. First, we wanted to mimic the auto-inhibited state by using a peptide that will dock into this auto-inhibitory interface and thereby block the system in an auto-inhibited state. And we then also designed a DNA aptamer that can intercalate in the central region of the DNA and thereby block strand exchange. So both of these methods work in vitro, so we can inhibit transposition in vitro with this, and we can inhibit DNA recombination. So, to be more precise, in vitro with these, with both of these probes, and we are now moving into testing these in vivo. We have also performed unbiased screens and have some some candidates from a pilot that we will be following up on for inhibiting transposition in bacteria. So running out of time, but just to give you a snapshot that this is not only, so the mechanisms that we have discovered are not only relevant to the vancomycin-resistant carrying TN1549 element, but are more general across the TN916-like family. So then we, reached back to our phylogenetic analysis and then compared, looked whether the key structural features that we find to be important for the mechanism of TN1549 are conserved across the family. And in fact, what you see here is that both DNA binding elements and the residues involved in base flipping and DNA melting and also the auto-inhibitory interactions seem to be conserved across this family. But they are actually not conserved to other families, and so we are now moving into other classes of conjugated transposons to get a broader view of how these things move and what are the differences and what's the spectrum of type of mechanisms that are there. So additionally, we are also very excited to go more systemic and see how transposons move in real life. And two main purposes. First of all, I think it's very important to see how these transfer events happen, what are the mechanistic features that are important for this and are not, but also to pick up mobile elements from real life that are actually moving very frequently so that we can focus our mechanistic studies to the most important elements. And for this, I have set up a collaboration with clinicians and bioinformaticians and also chemical and biology experts to track transposition in clinical samples. And so it's not only me, obviously. So at EMBL, we are also very excited to generate global resources to follow resistance in natural environments, especially with a special interest on soil in this particular case. So we would like to see how resistance emerges and moves in soil microbiota, but also see how antibiotic pollution in the environment affects resistant development. So in addition to global sampling that maybe on our backyard or or across the beaches of Tara, we would be excited to collect samples and look at resistance genes and resistance movement in differently impacted hotspots of soil samples. So this we will also parallel with local lab experiments where we would like to perturb soil or extracted microbiome from soil to see how resistance reacts to different perturbations. And so from all this, then we would like, we hope to create the mechanistic models, how resistance emerges and moves, and also pick out specific examples and study those, zoom into them and study them more with our structural and mechanistic tools. So with this, I'm finished. I have mentioned on my slides all the people, like the main people from my lab who have been involved in this and our collaborators. And I'm extremely grateful to the Embelcor facilities. None of this would be doable without all that. And the funders, obviously. And thank you for your attention.